My name is Alan Wong, chef owner of Alan Wong's restaurant. We cook Portuguese Samoan food, and that's why we're here talking. Well, I think, you know, you probably know already, but a lot of people don't know because my last name is Wong. I was born in Japan, in Tokyo. My mom is born in Japan, and she's raised in Japan. And so my dad and my mom got divorced when I was 7 years old. And I came to Hawaii when I was 5. And so being divorced, when we first came to Hawaii, we lived with our Chinese grandparents. My grandfather was the cook of the house. And so I ate his Chinese food. But because they were divorced when I was 7, I was raised on a lot of Japanese food. And my mom's adjustment to Hawaii and America was she would cook Japanese food for herself. We were in Hawaii, in America for the first time, and we were adjusting to American food, but we had a little bit in Japan because we lived in an army base. And then she remarried to a Filipino man, so she was cooking Filipino food. So she would cook 3 kinds of food sometimes, and her food was simple because she had something salty, a pickle, you know, tsukemono. She might have something vinegared or slightly sweet, sonomono, like namasu. And then she'd have things in the refrigerator like kimchi or kimpira and stuff like that. And she loved fish, so her meal could be pickles and rice, or pickles and rice and fish. And then she'd make a Filipino dish for her husband, and then she'd try to do something for me and my sister. You know, so we had a wide variety.
Wow, what kind of Filipino food did she do? Did you eat the Filipino food then?
Yes. I got introduced to Filipino food. Some of it was pretty wild for me when I was a kid, but the pork adobo, the chicken adobo, the pinakbet, the kalamongay, the marungay, you know, the chicken soup, you know, all, it's second nature to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so I am very familiar with Japanese ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when we had our restaurant in Japan, the eventual owners came to me and says, we want you to take this, the King Street restaurant,
mm-hmm.
and bring it to Japan.
Mm-hmm.
We think the Japanese will like it because they're already coming here because
mm-hmm.
The flavors are very familiar to them. So the use of all the different kinds of miso, all the different kinds of soy sauce, the wasabi, the ginger, the sesame, you know. Like for example, for a lot of Americans, they thought soy sauce was just soy sauce. So when I did my apprenticeship at the Greenbrier in West Virginia, they used La Choy soy sauce. You know, it wasn't Kikkoman, it wasn't Aloha, it wasn't Yamasa, it was La Choy. And a legitimate soy sauce, but very different. So,
Wow. Uh-huh.
You know, so they thought, oh, this is soy sauce. Let's make teriyaki sauce. And every soy sauce has its own nuances, yeah? And so now, with people traveling a lot more, with TV, you know, everyone's has already discovered Japan, the cooking techniques, the ingredients, and so American chefs, European chefs are flocking to Japan to learn more about Japanese ingredients and Japanese cooking. And they're coming away very, very excited and enthused about learning what they learned and trying to incorporate them into their cuisine back in America.
Okay, so then maybe that started, this guy says, in the 70s, 80s.
Yeah.
So is it still going on, you would say?
Oh, yes, it is. I think it got even more crazy when Tokyo received more Michelin stars, or Japan in total, Tokyo than Paris, and Japan in total than Europe. I shouldn't say Europe, France. You know, that was a wake up. So like, it's a buzz. Everybody wants to go there and check it out. You know, everybody is discovering Kaiseki cuisine all of a sudden. You know what I mean? And Japan is, I'm sure there are other countries, but one of the few that does this so well. Generations after generations, they keep doing the same thing. They inherit it, they take over, and they just do one thing, and they're very good at it. You know? And it's not about having to change or having to recreate or refresh, they just do it well. Mm-hmm. Whether it's unagi don or unagi in general, tempura house.
From what
house.
You see, is that going to have any longevity? I mean, can they keep that up?
Well, I'll tell you a side story. About 15 years ago, I was in Japan reading a Japanese newspaper, but written in English. And the story was about how the generation, the older people, are afraid that the new generation, the younger generation, they don't eat at home anymore as often. So the fast food has come to Japan, and so the kids are wanting to eat at Pizza Hut, Kentucky Fried Chicken, you know, McDonald's and Burger King, right? And so they were concerned that because they're not eating at home, they're not eating mom's or grandma's food anymore, the flavors and the taste. And so for a woman, what are they going to cook when they get kids? They no longer know what it tastes like. They don't know how to cook it. So what's going to happen in the next generation? So this is happening worldwide now, but I read that first in Japan. And so when you think about, okay, so here's another story. The average age of the U.S. farmer is 65 years old. The kids watch the parents struggle, make a buck. The right, you know, cost of doing business and expenses are rising. The profit margins are smaller. Kids today have far more opportunities than kids 20, 30 years ago. So who wants to take over the farm? Nobody. So a good example is Sumida Farms out in Pearl Ridge, Watercress. They have kids, but nobody wants to take over the farm. So if no kid wants to take over the farm, nobody wants to buy the farm, guess what happens? They sell it to somebody, a real estate guy. They pour cement on this beautiful water, and we will see Pearl Ridge 3. Sad. So I told you two stories to answer one question. Will the next generation take over these small businesses? Well, it depends on the kids. In the meantime, there are less kids now in Japan than a long time ago. So it depends on the next generation of kids, if they want to do that, if they want to work that hard.
Do people here want to work that hard?
No.
I mean, you've got Alan Wong University. You know, you're known for this, Alan. Do kids here want to work that hard?
In general, I don't think so. You hear them apply for jobs at 18 years old, right out of culinary school, and they're looking, and in the interview, they talk about work-life balance. I think it's important, but there's a time to go to school, there's a time to pay your dues, there's a time to become a sous chef, and there's a time to become a chef. But right off the bat, you know, work-life balance, I cannot understand that. Cannot. This profession is not an easy profession. You have to be about doing something daily, consistently, and striving to become better every day. So that's one thing. So will this unagi shop continue to be the unagi shop? I don't know. Can't say. I hope so, because when you go back to Japan, that's where I like to go eat. You know, you do the basics. Eat curry, eat the tempura, you know, and eat unagi, and eat the best that Japan has to offer. And sometimes when we used to go to the old Tsukiji market, we used to stop at one of these stands and eat ramen before we went into the market. And the best is when it's in wintertime, it's really cold, and you order your bowl, and you stand up eating, and you get real satisfied, tastes great, then you walk into the fish market at like 6 in the morning.
Yeah, I know. You walk around with a cup with a like a big oyster miso soup in it.
and then if you like it, you just keep on going back, right? And then you notice it when they close.
Do you think that certain kinds of food requires certain kinds of eaters? Do you know what I mean? Because I read this one and I brought it for you because I thought that you might be able to comment on this. Verger, one of the Nouvelle Cuisine people, in his obituary, it says here. In 1985, he said, this nouvelle cuisine, it's nothing serious. Now it looks Japanese. Large dishes, small portions, no taste, but very expensive. So he could be talking about where people try to go back to ingredients and then they make it more simple, and then he says no taste. Then he says, the nouvelle cuisine guys, experimented with lighter sauces, new vegetables, fruit and meat combinations. He said, speaking of the early days of nouvelle cuisine, but we already understood the basics we had learned early. Our palates had already been conditioned. What is he talking about?
I think it's simple. I think when you're raised and you grow up in a certain country, you get conditioned and used to the flavors and, you know, ingredients in that area. I'm sure if he was still alive today, he would have taken many more trips to Japan. And today, he would be thinking like, where have I been all this time? I should have gone to Japan 100 times during my career, you know? I would use the word subtle. Sometimes the food is subtle, you know? But that's the way the Japanese think sometimes. They don't want you to figure it out. They don't want you to pick out an ingredient. They want, you know, when you think of Japanese cooking, sometimes at the very highest levels, they want it to be harmonious. Things blend together, you know? They take this ingredient from this ocean, the seaweed where the currents like collide, it's very dangerous to dive for the seaweed. They make a dashi out of that. They take the water from this mountain, the springs in this mountain. And you know, can you taste the difference between this water and that water? No, you cannot, probably, you know, unless this one has a lot of chlorine in it. But you have to appreciate the time and energy they take into getting these ingredients to create something very, very refined and sophisticated. Do they have that in Japan? Yes. Do they have that in the south of France, where Verger came from? Yes. But he's used to a different set of ingredients. Maybe he uses olives, tomatoes, and capers, and eggplant more, whereas in Japan, they don't use a whole lot of that. Maybe that's what he meant by conditioning.
Mm. Or something like, if I don't know the story, am I going to be able to taste the difference?
Exactly.
Maybe not.
Well, take for example a chicken stock, a veal stock, compare that to a light dashi. You know, you have to appreciate both. Because both cooks, both chefs are pouring their heart into it, their craft. How can you condemn one?
Do you think that having great food in your city requires having people, smart eaters, people who really know how to eat? Like, you know, do like food critics taste things in a different way, or do they taste other things than just anybody who posts 5 stars on Yelp?
Oh, you know, I was in New York City working at Lutèce, where Chef Andre sold there. And whenever a food writer came in, he would inspect every plate to see what was left over on the plate. Because a rating by the New York Times was the thing back then. Michelin was not rating New York at that time. And so social media was not born at that time. So they thrived on 4 stars was the highest. You know, if you had 4 stars, that was the highest the New York Times could give you, and that meant business was good.
Well, we're relying on this journalist taste buds here. Mm-hmm. What are they tasting?
So when the food writer changed from Mimi Sheraton to this guy, Brian something. His name will come back to me. The first thing all the old French chefs did was, who is this guy? You know? What credentials does he have? What right does he have to determine my future? You know what I mean? And so they were very critical of the guy, because Mimi Sheraton was there for a long time. They knew Mimi, they trusted her, they knew that she knew what she was talking about. And today, everybody's a food critic on social media, right? And so, yeah, I think we went through this phase where everybody was like rejecting that idea and saying, who are you to like, you know, really criticize me? This is my livelihood. You could change my my whole business.
Mm-hmm.
And then it happened for a long time. And so now social media just accepted, right? But then you could have somebody that doesn't know anything about cooking. It just might not be your taste. You just might not be as well versed in culinary things. It just is not your thing. And you're going to like blast a restaurant? Well, it's happening.
I just don't see subtle flavors winning out in this battlefield here. You know what I'm saying?
Or there's another angle, yeah? If the wait staff is not properly telling the story of the dish or the ingredients, then the customer's not going to get it.
Mm.
So an inexperienced or not trained server will not be able to tell that story. So sometimes we just went to Hilo and we did the Adopt a Beehive program thing, you know. And so we took some staff with us. And so there was one girl in front of the house. She can actually talk from experience what she experienced there, because she put on a bee suit and she extracted the bees from the hive and the whole thing and saw the whole process. You know, so unless they get that kind of training, they're not going to be able to tell the story. But that's why we do that, you know, bring people on farms so they can hear it straight from the farmers or the producers and tell the story.
Super. I mean, but how's that, you know, working together whole effort going? Farmers and restaurant people. Must be pretty tight by now, right?
Yeah, I think farmers are, you know, wanting to get more publicity. They want to sell more product. They want to live and stay in business, you know. So the more publicity they get, the more they sell, the more money they make, the more they grow.
Farmers that you interact with, does it seem like they're doing pretty well?
Every farmer is different. Every farmer has their own tipping point where they know they can grow more, you know, because they're not going to grow too much, because the demand needs to be there, the public awareness needs to be there, and people are going to like their product. So the age of the farmer is changing. You know, people like the Shin Ho's from Ho Farms, they're young. There's a Kylie Matsuda on the North Shore. She's young. They're going to take over the farms, and they connect more to the younger chefs, right? I'm one of the older guys.
Uh-huh.
And some of the older farmers are retiring or passing it on to their kids.
I mean, do you see it working well, that system one could imagine, right, of chefs and farmers really assuring a market for their crop and that kind of thing?
I think since 1991, when the Hawaii Regional Cuisine Chefs got together, there were zero farmers markets. And today, you got farmers markets almost every day of the week from all over the island. So there are venues to present your stuff. Back then, I can't remember if there were any farmers in Foodland or Times or in the supermarkets. You know, Dino Kimoto from Nalo Farms sold his product in the supermarkets. Now you see Shin Ho tomatoes and green beans and whatnot, and other farmers are in the markets. And so they're making a good living. They're getting more exposure, and it's becoming more mainstream, so that the products from the farmers are not only reserved for the chefs and restaurants now, or hotels. You know, the housekeeper, home cook, can buy their product in supermarkets and bring them home to cook with. And that's kind of a cool thing, because I think Hawaii regional cuisine is more like a spirit, a way we eat. You know?
What way is that?
Well, I'll give you the short definition of Hawaii regional cuisine for me. It's a style of cooking that borrows from all the ethnic influences you find in Hawaii. And so you got the Chinese who came first to work the plantation fields. The short history is there was nothing here. The Polynesians came. That was the first migration. Then the second migration of people were the tall ships. You know, think Marco Polo, Christopher Columbus, think Captain Cook. They came. Now, these two groups brought food with them. So the Portuguese brought like chili peppers. You know, they had chilies on board to prevent scurvy. They had salt salmon, salt cod, salt meat. That's how they came here, because salmon was not here. There was nothing here. You know, so they brought the taro, the breadfruit, the pigs, the chickens, the dogs, and the whole thing. Then the third wave was when somebody brought sugar and pineapple, plantation was born. And then on these ships, disease came. So two-thirds of the Hawaiian population were decimated. And they were the field workers. So the first place they went to was China. The Chinese men came, they worked on the plantation. I think they got paid $6 to $9 a month. Then the Portuguese, the Puerto Ricans, and the Japanese came, the Okinawans, the Koreans, and last the Filipinos. So these were the original immigrants. Two-thirds of the local population today are made up of Japanese, Chinese, Filipino. And so that's what influenced how we ate a long time ago, and it still influenced how we eat today. So I draw inspiration from that. You know, and with a French background or a training, I use old techniques that I've learned, and I incorporate all the immigrant ingredients. We try to utilize as much local ingredients as possible. And so I use this term, I like for the guests to taste Hawaii. So you taste Hawaii by us featuring locally raised produce, fruits and vegetables, as much locally produced things like the beef, the chicken, the pork and whatnot, whatever you can find, the eggs, dairy, as much as possible. And then you take ingredients that local people grew up eating. Like we grew up eating crack seed or lihimui. You know, the preserved seeds that the Chinese brought over. And things like char siu, manapua, dim sum, kimchi, lap chong, you know. Then dishes besides ingredients, cold ginger chicken, loco moco, spam musubi, you know, these things. And so that's when you incorporate the ingredients, you're again tasting Hawaii. So we have a whole tomato salad, a whole tomato sitting on a dressing made from lihimui. And so the story is, well, local people, I grew up eating lihimui, cracked seed. And so I've taken that flavor and ingredient and made a salad dressing out of it, serving it with a tomato. Or you could see a restaurant, sometimes you take an iconic dish like loco moco.
Oh gosh, I know you've done that so many ways.
But to do it here in this restaurant, I've got to reduce the portion 4 times and make it a little bit more refined, right? Because I can't just serve a regular loco moco in this restaurant because the expectations are different. You know, when we had the pineapple room, it was a traditional loco moco. So an old iconic dish refreshed and made contemporary. So these are the ways that the people can taste Hawaii, you know?
I know what you're saying, and I'm also seeing the way you describe it, why this is like a more of a fine dining place. I mean, because kind of the picture I'm getting is that, well, people who really had technique are filtering the local ingredients and making things using French techniques and stuff, whereas another generation of people really aren't doing that kind of synthesis of ingredients as much.
In the cooking world, only in my opinion, we're in the YouTube age. So, you know, when I was growing up in the industry, you chose a place and you worked there for years and you're hoping that you learn. And the chef teaches you things and new things. And the more new things you learn, the more you stay. Well, anyway, today if you want to learn how to make a dish, you go on YouTube and it teaches you anything. The problem is, when you go on YouTube, it doesn't tell you if it tastes right or not. But here's a concern, just like that story from Japan, okay, about the next generation. You deny yourself the opportunity to be mentored. Okay? Now, when you deny yourself to be mentored, when you are the mentor to a younger chef, when you're the head chef now, and the cook comes to you for advice, It could sound like this. You want to learn how to make duck a la ranch? Go on YouTube. It's crazy. I say it sounds crazy, but if that's how you're learning today, you don't know how to teach. You don't know how to teach and how to mentor. Maybe you don't know duck a la ranch either.
Yeah, right.
I mean, do you need to serve duck a la ranch today? Almost nobody does. But the techniques are important to learn. It's about making a gastrique, incorporating fruit with protein.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It does. You know, it happened on a certain level in certain cuisines, and now you just see it like maybe somebody throws a little, you know, preserves in on something at the last minute or something. I mean, I'm just trying to, there is a difference, isn't there? That's what I'm trying to say.
Or creating food that is Instagrammable. So it looks great, or it looks wild. It's a great photo.
Yeah.
But I don't know how it tastes. Or sensationalizing something. And chefs getting famous because they have so many followers on social media and so many hits. You know? And so, on one hand, it's good for your business. So I always say, anybody can open a restaurant, but can you keep it going? Because it's like a relationship. The honeymoon's easy, but the maintenance part of any relationship is the hardest thing, because you always gotta refresh. Otherwise, it gets stale, and you know, nothing good happens when it's stale. You just gotta keep moving forward, you know?
What do you think, you know, if the key to, well, California cuisine, Hawaii regional cuisine, was going back to really, really great ingredients, what's the secret to moving that kind of cuisine forward, other than just doing less to the great ingredients?
Well, I think, you know, you got to understand what was available in Hawaii back then in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. The best thing about Nouvelle cuisine was it was a break from classical cuisine.
Yeah. And Yamashita says now people don't have to prove themselves by being able to have that French technique. Is that true?
It could be. It could be. It was pretty structured back then. When a dish sounded like a la something, a la Cardinal, it had to be a la Thermidor, a la Newburgh. it meant you had to have these ingredients, it had to be cooked this way, and whatnot, and had to taste this way. Very structured. So Nouvelle cuisine was a break from that. And when we had Hawaii regional cuisine born in 1991, the best thing about it was a break from what was being offered in Hawaii at that time. You know, we had a couple of French restaurants, a couple of Italian. At that time, we probably didn't know if it was authentic or not. We had the luau, which was slowly becoming more commercialized. We had ethnic restaurants. But the hotels were offering continental cuisine. So the same menu could appear in San Francisco, Chicago, New York, and Hawaii. The continental menu sounded like Tornado's Rossini, Filet Mignon, Chateaubriand, Duck a la Ranch, you know?
Seafood Newburgh.
Seafood Newburgh, Steak Diane, right? Roast Rack of Lamb Provençal. You know, you could find this stuff anywhere in a continental menu restaurant. And so we broke from that. So like in the hotels, because the local people are primarily Chinese, Japanese, and Filipino, if you went into the employee cafeteria on lunch break, you would see a Chinese dish, a Filipino dish, or a Japanese dish, because those were your workers. Then you take notice of the ingredients they were using, and all of a sudden, the chefs are putting it mainstream onto restaurant menus. Things that you'd find in employee cafeterias or only at home.
I know, bitter melon.
Okay.
Yeah.
Or something like opihi. How many times would you find opihi in a restaurant back then?
I had an opihi shooter the first time I came here.
Exactly. So it used to be only at home, or only at parties or luaus, you'd find opihi. You know? And so to put it in your restaurant was another deal. But that's what happened with HRC was born. You know, it was a break from the past, and now all of a sudden, it's okay to use, you know, opihi. It's okay to use nori and furikake on your restaurant menus and lapchong on your menus, and, you know, not just reserved for Chinatown. You know, stuff like that.
Did Hawaii regional cuisine change things in the kitchen at all? Hierarchies or ways of...
Well, when you go back to the classical continental menus in hotels, most of them were all held by Europeans. And now you see a lot of local people as sous chefs and head chefs and even executive chefs. And appropriately, because if the hotel is committing to buying local, supporting local and more local flavors, they know more than a European chef, unless the European chef was well versed in that, or the European chef spent time in Asia.
There really has been a huge change, hasn't there? Yeah.
Yeah.
We're eating really differently now, too.
Uh-huh. And so when you think about the potlucks, where everybody brings a dish, maybe before HRC, it used to be the same thing. But now, because they're eating out more, they're getting more ideas. There are more ingredients available. And so what they bring to the potluck is changing too. So it's changed the way Hawaii cooks, not only eats. They might be saying, "Hey, I just went to so-and-so's restaurant. I tried this sauce. I'm going to try and recreate it and bring it to the kind of auntie's party tomorrow." You know, that kind of thing.
Oh, that would be fantastic.
That's kind of cool though, right?
Yeah, that is. Like, I'm going to try and make that tofu poke or you know, wheat berry salad or whatever.
So when you said poke, it reminded me. So, like, I use moro miso just like I use salt.
What is that?
Moro miso.
Moro?
Moro miso. So you can make miso out of, like, rice, soybean. You can make miso out of anything. Okay? So this one's made from barley. And you take the mixture that's fermenting before the stage where you get the soy sauce or you get the miso. Uh-huh. And so it's still, like, not totally 100% disintegrated. So the barley is still a little pebble. And it's still loose and not real thick.
Oh, yeah?
And so I did a thing. I researched how much milligrams of sodium there are in 1 tablespoon of kosher salt, table salt, Hawaiian salt, soy sauce, the different soy sauces, fish sauce. And so a cook woke me up one day and says, "You put salt in there?" And he said, "No." But I found out he put fish sauce. And the fish sauce had more sodium than the salt.
Uh-huh.
So there's this box here I created called sodium. Right?
Uh-huh.
The moro miso, a tablespoon of salt is around 1,200 milligrams of sodium.
Oh, I see.
The soy sauce, fish sauce, about 1,300 milligrams of sodium. To put that into perspective, a can of Campbell soup sometimes has 1,800 milligrams of sodium. One of the high ones is instant ramen. Okay? That package of soup and the noodles itself, high salt, high fat. So, moro miso, 1 tablespoon, a little over 500. So if I use moro miso like salt, sprinkling it here and there, I'm using only 40% of the salt. Plus, I get a whole bunch of umami and body.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's like the difference between adding salt and an anchovy to the sauce.
Right, yeah, yeah, right.
You get the sodium, but you get the body. You know?
Mm.
So I've been making poke with moro miso. Oh, you go home and you try that.
Oh my gosh.
Very flavorful, but it's better for you sodium-wise.
I'm going to try that. You know, what does Hawaii do better than anybody else?
Food-wise?
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to say... That's a dangerous question, but I'm going to say local food. Poke is a local food. It comes from the Hawaiians. So, you know, poke, there's a poke explosion on the mainland right now.
I know. Is it seen as Hawaiian? I guess it is.
One of the biggest misconceptions is people that think that everything comes from Hawaii is Hawaiian. Where Hawaiian is a race, like Samoan, Tahitian, Fijian. Not everything comes from Hawaii is Hawaiian. So you might hear this on the beach. A couple talking to the other couple. You know, where should we go eat tonight? Oh, you got to try this Hawaiian restaurant. We just went to this great Hawaiian restaurant. And maybe they went to Alan Wong's or Roy's. But we don't serve Hawaiian food. We serve the food of modern day Hawaii. Not Hawaiian food. You want to go to Hawaiian food, go to Helena's. You know, I used to go to Ono's Hawaiian food. Now they closed already. But that's Hawaiian food. The poke was a gift from the Hawaiians. Yes. But I've gone to the mainland many times and tried poke, and there was so much bad poke out there.
I know. I don't know what to do about that. Mm-hmm. It's hard to claim it as something you're proud of.
So I think some of them are smart. You know, they make you stand in line and they say, okay, pick your ingredients. You go down the line, and by the end, you got like 6 or 7 ingredients and make your own poke bowl, right? So it's smart because if the thing tastes junk, it's your fault. You added all the ingredients.
That's okay. Sriracha mayo, you're good.
Yeah. Boy, you got to put the tobiko inside it, too.
Oh, God, no.
The sweet tobiko.
But I'm asking you, what do we do really well? Because I'm just wondering if there's anything people would have to come here to eat.
So I say local food because let's take, for example, kalbi, teriyaki beef, right? Now, What we do here in Hawaii does not exist in that country. Teriyaki exists in Japan, but 20, 30 years ago, it never existed. They do use soy sauce, mirin, soy sauce, sugar. The flavor profile is there, but they don't call them teriyaki. It's an American thing.
What?
Kalbi is like, you know, when I was asking people there, originally the kalbi was not marinated, or you can get kalbi not marinated, and that the heavy seasoning, the marination, came during the war when they had inferior product, and they had to like hide the flavor a little bit, you know?
Mm.
And so they said white kimchi was more popular than spicy kimchi. So they had to add the spice and heavily spice it so that you take the inferior cabbage and so you cannot smell.
Mm-hmm.
So stuff like that, out of necessity, we're born. And so I think we have created our own hybrid flavors for the local people in Hawaii. So even teriyaki meat, if you eat teriyaki meat in Hawaii, okay, you get this. But you go eat teriyaki in West Virginia, it could be very different because they didn't grow up with that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I guess I'm just wondering, what is so special here that people would have to come and have it here? If there's anything like that, you know?
Adobo, oxtail soup. You go to another country, you eat oxtail soup, it's great. But you come here, this is for the local people. And everybody puts their own little ingredients inside the oxtail, right? Some put mustard cabbage, some put long rice, some put like shiitake mushrooms. I love it with the mustard cabbage and the long rice and the shiitake.
Is that Okinawan? Is that kind of Okinawan style?
Could be. Yeah, Okinawan's had a big impact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess I just don't realize that other places don't have that, so we have it. That's us, you know. That's what we have that nobody else has.
Uh-huh. And so another good one is the Japanese have sukiyaki. But then, what is chicken heka?
Yeah.
Right? You ask a lot of young kids, they don't know what heka is, you know.
Really? Yeah, I guess, because their moms never made it.
But I think heka came more from the country.
Yeah.
It's like a farmer's dish.
I know, and you used to be able to order it in a lot of different restaurants, but no, not now.
Same flavor profile. Maybe a little sweeter.
Yeah.
But the sweetness comes from where you come from, you know? You know, Okinawa is further south, so maybe a little sweeter.
Where do you think our food is going? Do you think we're in kind of a you know, Hawaii regional cuisine kind of peaked and went down, or peaked and is still going? What?
Well, I would say that, you know, we as a group don't meet anymore. But it doesn't mean it's dead. I think the spirit lives on.
Is there a new movement happening?
No. There was one, but it kind of...
What was it?
Hawaii Island Chefs. I think so. It was the next generation. They had met a couple of times, but I guess their leadership wasn't strong enough to kind of maintain that momentum. So they met a couple of times, and you just don't hear about them anymore.
Because you have to have a point. You know, when you guys got together, you had a point to make.
We had two. Okay. One was to help develop an agricultural network in the state of Hawaii. So with the help of the Department of Ag, all the chefs divulged our information. So no cell phones back then, no email, fax numbers and telephone numbers and addresses of all the farmers that we bought from. So the Department of Ag collected all of that, plus some of their own stuff, and created a thin little booklet that they passed out. So mission accomplished. And the proof that it's still, the spirit is still alive, is that we have the most amount of farmers markets than ever before. And these young cooks have the most ingredients to cook with than ever before. So that spirit kept on. The farming community is growing. And the fact that a lot of the younger cooks are cooking with local product, and you know, we're trying to do more agriculturally, bring awareness and make more farms and make Hawaii more sustainable, because the Department of Ag also made a study about 5 years ago. We import over 85% of our food into Hawaii. So they said if we could move the dial back 10% to 75%, things like the hurricane or the flood that happened in Thailand or in Japan, if it happened here in Hawaii, it would be far more devastating here. Because we rely on the barge or the plane for food to come in, this place would shut down if there was like a major disaster like that. It's easier to get food into Japan and Thailand than it is here in Hawaii. But anyway, okay, you move the dial back 10%, you create 2,300 jobs, generate $6 million in taxes, good for our economy, the farming community gets $94 million, and the economy gets $188 million, all that stuff. So we're working on the sustainability piece. That's why agriculture is becoming more of a necessity now.
Right. What organization is it, would you say really has their finger on that part of this process here?
The Hawaii Ag Foundation.
Hawaii Ag Foundation.
Of which Denise Yamaguchi heads and Roy and I are on the board. So it's connected to the Hawaii Food and Wine Festival. She oversees two of them.
The Ag Foundation's got to be the one, right? Because everybody points to, we got to get the product.
The second goal of the HRC guys was to tell everyone, the world, simply that there was a new cuisine happening in Hawaii. And so was born a cookbook called The New Cuisine of Hawaii, written by Janice Wald Henderson. So 12 chefs, 12 chapters. Each chef had his own chapter. So this became the thing where we could give away, or people could buy, and learn about the new cuisine in Hawaii. So as far as like telling the world that there was a new shift, a new cuisine, that was accomplished too. And when you think about the spirit that is still growing, or still alive, you know, the supermarket thing, people are eating differently, they're cooking differently, they're more aware of the ingredients available and the farmers in general, that's still growing. That sustainability thing keeps everybody moving forward. That 10% piece keeps everybody moving forward on that. And, you know, with the Hawaii Food and Wine Festival, people are seeing that all the products that we have.
Oh, yeah.
And people are seeing that when they come, we invite over 120 chefs.
Do they start importing things from here?
Sometimes. I did an event with Thomas Keller, who, when he only had the French Laundry out in Maui, and I used moi, and he started to buy moi. I used Hearts of Palm. He started to buy Hearts of Palm for the French Laundry. For the French Laundry. And so as these mainland chefs, as the international chefs come, and we ask them to cook with local product, they get more exposed to that. Some of them actually do buy stuff, and they ship them over. I know Hearts of Palm is growing all over the United States.
I don't get Hearts of Palm. I don't get it. I still gotta discover it, I guess.
Really?
Yeah.
Where do you live?
Here.
Here. And you haven't had it?
I've had it. I just don't get it.
You don't get the flavor?
Well, yeah.
Okay. So now, a traditional kind of European ingredient was only found in cans.
Yeah.
And now they're raising it. Something else that used to be only in cans and then frozen was asparagus. Now they grow asparagus. You know, so that there's the shift again. Things were only in cans or frozen, and now we're starting to grow them. Traditional European ingredients like leeks and artichokes, they're not Asian stuff. The Europeans came, they said, hey, can you grow artichokes? Somebody grew artichokes. They're not very abundant right now, but you can find them. Or leeks.
Here?
Yep, in Hawaii. You gotta really search. But you go ask Japanese for Tokyo Negi, oh, we know where to find that.
Uh-huh. You know, where's fun to eat here in Honolulu for you?
Fun?
Uh-huh.
Well, you have so many new restaurants popping up, like the izakayas, the Korean restaurants, the Southeast Asian restaurants. Once in a while, you find one that's doing something different.
Uh-huh.
You know, I haven't tried it yet, but down the road there's that vegan izakaya.
Yeah.
I want to try that because it's kind of interesting, just the concept, yeah? You ever had a raw macadamia nut?
No. No. Is that good?
go search for one.
Okay.
And then the next time you eat the top part, the Hearts of Palm is the top and the bottom. They're two different textures and two different taste sensations.
Oh, yeah.
Take a slice from the top and eat it. And just close your eyes and think you're eating macadamia nut, the raw one. The unroasted one.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Crunchy,
mm-hmm.
Kind of milky, has a subtle aroma. There's a word sort of subtle again, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the bottom, maybe go treat like bamboo.
Yeah.
Put them in your simmer dish.
Hmm.
Take the tops, try steam them. Steam them, eat them hot, soft. Cool it down. Eat it cold, soft, with your favorite vinaigrette.
Hmm.
You might change your opinion on Hearts of Palm.
Okay.
At minimum, shave it real thin, like you would shave something thin on your salad.
Mm-hmm.
So when you eat it, it has this different texture to it.
Hmm. That's what somebody has to do with so many ingredients, right? To get people to just try and then seek it out and then buy it and then make people grow it more. And
That reminds me of cheese. The Asian people are not a big cheese-eating culture. Stinky, right? More European thing. And so when the goat cheese farmers surfaced, they make fresh goat cheese versus the aged goat cheese.
Uh-huh.
So this fresh cheese is almost like the ricotta texture. And it was perfect because it was mild. It wasn't stinky. It wasn't goaty. I mean, if you eat an aged goat cheese, the first comment I had was, tastes like somebody's armpit. You know? But to get a local person to eat goat cheese with that first impression of goat cheese, it had to have been mild. Like you drink sweet wines before you graduate to the drier wines. You drink the sweet white wines before you graduate to the dry white wines, and then you graduate to the red wines. We had to graduate from mild cheese to more stinky cheese each time. And now we have the most cheese available than ever before. We have more cheese-making people than ever before.
Here? In Hawaii?
In Hawaii.
Mm.
You have Big Island goat dairy.
Yeah.
You got the Maui one, surfing goat. there are like three people I know of on the Big Island that grow goat cheese.
Oh.
Emma Bello out in Wailua is raising goats for goat cheese.
Oh, Naked, that's amazing.
Naked Cow Dairy, the two sisters who started that in Waianae. Mm-hmm. You know, they're growing milk cheeses. So it's like that way it's growing.
Oh, that is. See, this is so great to have somebody with an overview that we can tell that is growing.
There were three dairies here on Oahu at one time, and then there were none.
Yeah.
Because of the cost of doing business, the rules and regulations. And then you had started with the two sisters on at Waianae, who are not raising cows for milk, but for cheese. Emma Bell is the second one. And if there are other people making cheese, I'm not aware of them yet on this island.
Oh, that is really great to know. I guess people just look you up and try to show their things to you. Is that how you find out?
Yeah, because they're looking for business too, right? The first thing you got to do is like get your name out there and pass out samples and, hey, I'm here, this is what I do. That's easy.
Have you seen anything else on the horizon that's going to be big, that's coming up here that we got that, you know?
I say we got the best mangoes in the world.
We do, I know we do. But nobody does anything with them, you know? They're lying on the ground. People drive around with boxes of them in their car. And then they're $4.59 in the store. I don't know. There's something funny about mangoes.
But that's not new, right? What's new? What's new?
You're right. We do have the best mangoes, though.
I think so, yeah.
My mother even said, I hope I live one more year so I can eat more mango.
And there's nothing like having a pineapple that was grown in Hawaii and picked in Hawaii.
Oh, yeah.
I used to work in the pineapple fields out in Waiheoapa, Dole. And the fresh fruit was intended to be exported. So they'd pick one and they'd show you, and it was in the can right there when you pick it so that you can see what was wanting to be picked. The exported one was 1/8 ripe. It was black and purple, very little green orange. Because if the box bled juice, they rejected the entire shipment back then. So they wanted these hard ones that wouldn't bleed in transport.
Oh boy.
Mm-hmm. Versus the fresh fruit, okay, the one that stayed in Hawaii, it was like orange and beautiful and green and whatnot. So the mainland stuff, they have no idea what a pineapple in Hawaii can be like. Tropical fruits here. There is a Tropical Fruit Growers Association, and they have a lot of different kinds of things that don't make it to market.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh.
Oh, I'm going to look them up.
Ken Love. Go talk to him.
Okay.
He lives in the Big Island. He
oh,
has this great,
great
tropical fruit growers poster.
Growers.
You know, things like not only sour sap, but the atemoya, the cherimoya. Oh, wonderful stuff. You heard of jabotikaba?
Oh, yeah. You know? I've tasted it, though. It's like a sour sap.
The atemoya and cherimoya are this kind of same family.
Yeah.
The moya family. The jabotikaba looks like a grape, a Concord grape. Thick skin. You can't eat the skin and stuff. And sometimes sour, but, you know, they make jabotikaba grape jam preserve out of that. You know, another local fruit that's not too much heard of, that's not very abundant. So stuff like that. Ken will give you a poster. He'll tell you everything
about
tropical fruits. That's what we have that not a lot of people have. Unless you go to a tropical climate. You know, I've always had a dream. There should be a food museum in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
A food museum in Hawaii that has collected all the cookbooks ever made in Hawaii about Hawaii food, or chefs that have produced books, every video, every cooking show from way back when, you know, that was ever like from, you know, Harry Kojima to Muriel Mura, you know, the Hawaiian Electric Kitchen, that they should house that, and where children can come in busloads to go see what was done in the past. It's a museum.
Oh, why? I mean, and different. This today we're featuring Portuguese food, pandus.
Learn the history of Hawaii's food. Have you ever been out to Hawaii Plantation Village?
Not recently.
Something like that in Waipahu, but it has it's a food thing.
Yeah, I think everybody would want to go there.
You know? And then you can answer questions like, why we eat the plate lunch? You know, why is it two scoops of rice, mac salad, and whatever you order?
More like, why am I here at Plantation Village and I'm not eating a plate lunch? Why? Yeah, this is the way to do it.
You know, why? How did the spam musubi get born? Why are we the highest consumer of spam in the United States? Give me the reason, you know? Stuff like that. How do you justify that? How do you explain that to somebody?
Oh my God, that is the best interactive museum I've heard of.
You know, where does shave ice come from? Right?
That is such a good one. Japan, right?
Uh-huh. What was it? Sweet ice. Right? You know? Just ice with syrup on it. You might hear a story that Napoleon Bonaparte had a say in that. You take snow and you put sugar water on top of the shave ice. I heard something like that too, though.
No, really?
Yeah, I did. You know? So, yeah, that's a dream of mine.
You know, everybody wants experiences these days. They don't want to just stand around and look at stuff. That it could be a good idea, a food museum, because, you know, that's why eating is so big now.
I think that's what they figured out. People came here in the 60s. They got married. So when they had kids, they come back a second time to show their kids where mom and dad got married. So when these kids they get married, they might think, let's go to Hawaii and get married like mom and dad did. You know? And so they get children. And then after a while, let's go have a reunion for mom and dad's 60th anniversary in Hawaii where they got married, right? So they figured out how many times the average person has come back to Hawaii. And they've had their chocolate-covered macadamia nut turndowns, the tea leaf greetings, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's gotten old already.
Mm.
They've been to a few luau's already. They figured it out already. It's not really Hawaiian. And so they're looking for these authentic experiences. So the most extreme could be, hey, I'm going to sign up for this pig hunting tour. I'm going to go and go really hunt for pig and go along. That's something you're never going to forget in your life. You know, stuff like that. That's why the farmer's market at KCC is real popular, especially with the Japanese. They think that that's where the locals go shop. It's outside of Waikiki. That's why they're venturing into places like Manoa Valley, Kailua, because that's where the locals eat. That's where they eat. That's where they shop. That's the community they live in. They want to go see that. They're tired of the old stuff already.
Mm-hmm.
And really, you want to go out into the community, get out of Waikiki, to see really the real colorful part of Hawaii. It's in the communities.
How would you describe Hawaii's food scene now?
Now? Restaurant explosion in the last 2-3 years. The most amount of restaurants ever. But a lot of the old mom and pops are closing, because the cost of doing business is increasing. Minimum wage is increasing. We need government help and legislation. But, you know, you don't see too much of the big restaurants opening anymore. You don't see too much of the fine dining restaurants opening anymore. They're smaller, maybe singular concepts. I do tacos, you know, or I do pizzas. I do robata, you know, I do izakaya, that kind of thing. Specialty things. So you can come to Hawaii and eat many, many different things today. And so these young kids, they've taken to heart what it means to buy local and support local. They like causes. They're into the social causes. You know, they want to get behind sustainable issues. So that's good. But a lot of them are opening and a lot of them are closing. You can open a business, but can you stay in business?
Overall, is the food better?
It depends. I think that everyone is more well-traveled. I think the entire world and food has come into your living room with Food TV Network and what's available on TV. You can learn about what's happening all over the world. You can get an idea of what to cook just by watching TV. You know, the magazines are getting better. There are more magazines now. And if you travel and you go and taste pad thai in Thailand, you have a better idea of creating that pad thai here in Honolulu in your restaurant. Yes. A lot of these chefs traveling to Japan, traveling to Korea, traveling to France, Spain, and they're seeing and eating and experiencing, and when they come back, they know what the flavor should be like. You know, not what they think it is because they ate it in a restaurant, but maybe they had a paella in Spain, and they're like, oh, I get it. You know, a real bouillabaisse in Marseille in the south of France, I get it. And so I would say, as a whole, yeah, we're all getting better. Cuisine is global now, and everybody's getting better at it. So therefore, I think the food is getting better, but the whole world's getting better too. Does that make sense?
Thanks so much. It's been so interesting talking with you.
You good?
Good. Thanks so much, Alan.
Okay.
Can I take a picture of you?
Of course. With the iceberg in the back?
Yeah.
You know why that's there?
Why?
The iceberg is only 10%. And what supports that iceberg to float is 90% on the bottom. So once in a while when I'm in training, I'll take this picture and say, what do people see? They see a full restaurant. They see you must be a millionaire. That's far from the truth. They see everybody happy and eating. They think opening a restaurant's easy, cooking in a restaurant's easy. But on the bottom is the hard work, the blood, sweat, tears, the commitment, the cleanliness, the organization, everything you can think of on the bottom that supports the top 10%. They see fame, they see fortune, they see money, they see busy, but it takes everything on the 90% to support that.
I'll take a picture of you with that. How do you keep quality consistent?
Well, for me personally, it's practice, practice, practice. Okay? That's why you see this stomach here. You gotta eat. You gotta always taste, taste, taste. So, my simple definition of cuisine is when the cooks begin to taste their own food. How can you make something and not taste it and know that the customer's gonna like it? So, I've reduced cooking down to three simple things. Number one is salt, seasoning. So, you make an employee meal today. And I reassure you, hey, don't be afraid. I'm going to eat it. All I'm going to check to see where your salt level is. Because you're down doesn't mean that you're not a good cook. Second thing is execution. If you're going to fry something, make sure it's crispy and not greasy. You know, a medium rare steak, it should be medium rare. Give me a salad that's nice and crispy and cold. Stuff like that. Execution. Don't give me a stew and give me a knife. Should be fork tender. You know, you give me white rice, should be cooked, not the kind with the bones and silver rice. And then last is balance. If you're making something like sweet sour, your idea of sweet sour, you might be too sweet, might be too sour. Stuff like that. Hot and sweet. But the first thing, season. Make sense? So you always got to taste, you always got to eat. And for the customers and the cooks, you have to do exactly that. You have to always taste their food before you earn my trust and I let you go. So if you're making a pan sauce, I might say to you, before you plate that, you give me every plate, I want to taste the spoon. You start getting it, okay? Then it's every other, then every third. Eventually, I take the training wheels off, okay, good to go. I taste your stuff maybe once a night, two times a night.
Really?
Yeah, that's the way I am.
I knew there had to be a reason.
So that's the answer to consistency. Everybody has to calibrate or recalibrate to me. So it's my salt level. It's my sugar level. Is what I balance. and you make sure they execute it.
How often are you here?
I'm here every day almost, but I'm not on the line. Getting too old now.
Is there someone else?
Paul. There's always been a chef de cuisine under me here.
You've influenced a lot of the way we eat around here. You have. What with your crop, people coming out?
You know, the people that work here that have kind of grown up with me here, and they've eaten a lot of my food. You know, they say I've spoiled them, because whenever they go out, they always think the same way. They have the same deduction process, you know. But when I go out to eat, I don't act like that. I don't do that. I just enjoy the moment. Because people are looking for me to do that. And I'm not going to spoil the moment. I just go out to have fun. I'll do that in my own head.
See, that's the palate.
It is. It is. You have to, I went to a second grade class because my niece was in it. And first question was, who get the best french fries? McDonald's. Second grade now, 7 years old. You'll get the second best french fries. Oh, Burger King. Okay. So I drew the palette. I said, okay, that's a palette memory. Okay. So I started with that, and I brought fresh strawberries from the Big Island, and I brought Wailua chocolate. So we're gonna dip fresh strawberries in chocolate. My goal was to have them develop palate memory for the best strawberry they ever ate, and the best chocolate covered strawberry they ever ate in their life at 7 years old. So if you can develop these palate memories of the best thing you ever ate in that category, I can tell you where I had the best cantaloupe in my life. It was in Sonoma Valley at a winery that had a farm. It's picked right. The best honeydew was in Japan, Shizuoka melon. You know, cost $100 for 1 million. So when you go to work at these places, when you go to eat at these places, and you understand flavor and taste, yeah, it can be subtle and still taste great.
What is one thing, one tip you could give to people in general to just develop their palate a little more? Is there anything?
A universal one? Never say no. Always take a thank you bite. It could be brains. It could be tripe. It could be liver. Take a thank you bite. You don't have to like it, but you have to take a thank you bite. It exposes you, right? I grew up eating only three vegetables, you know.
Corn.
Guess the other two.
Lettuce.
No.
Potatoes.
That's not a vegetable.
I don't know. Maybe you snuck it in there.
I had a gag thing.
Oh.
If you tried to force me, I'd put it in my mouth and I would I would throw up. Corn.
Oh, let's see. Corn. God, what could it be? Not broccoli. Not lettuce. You said lettuce. Cabbage? No way. beans? No, green beans? No. I know it could be.
When I was young,
cauliflower.
The first time I went to a dentist, he took an x-ray, put the cotton pad in the back, I threw up on the nurse. And so the reason why I say take a thank you bite is because when I got into the business and I went to cooking school, I said to myself, okay, I never eat this in my life. I'm going to have to take a thank you bite. This is the profession I chose. So I ate a celery for the first time, and so now you know I didn't eat celery. Or when you look at that raw oyster, and the oyster's looking back at you like, oh, eat me, and you don't want to eat the oyster because, you know, it looks ugly, you know? And when you put it in your mouth, it's slimy and gooey and doesn't taste really good, and you want to swallow it, you don't bite it. That's how you eat your first oyster. Swallow them. And you drink something right away after that. I ate an oyster, but you didn't really eat an oyster.
Green onions?
Peas.
Oh, yeah, peas. Oh, yeah, you ate peas. You ate lima beans. You didn't. You ate
only three vegetables.
Yeah, I know. Okay, corn peas, and carrots.
And tomatoes.
Tomatoes.
I would gag on tomatoes. In the fourth grade, I went to Kipapa Elementary. I think it's still the oldest public elementary school in the state. Out in YPU.
Yeah.
That was my sixth school in the fourth grade. Because we moved around. Yeah, my mom was a single mom trying to find work for her two kids. So it was the first school we had to walk to the cafeteria, bring our tray back to the room, eat it, then slop in the slop bucket, silverware in the slop bucket, you know, in the silverware bucket, and then we had to bring it back to the cafeteria, come back, and then we resume class. But we had to show the teacher our plate, make sure we eat our vegetables before we did that. And I never ate vegetables until that time, or a piece of tomatoes. And so the first day we had pickled beets, the cube kind. I told the teacher I'm allergic to beets. So she was probably thinking, you lying. Okay, you can go first day. So I went home and I thought, I'm in trouble now. Okay. So I used to put them in milk content. And so 2 weeks went by, and one day she picked up my milk content. Okay. I was stupid anyway, because she's sitting in the back of the class. She can see what we're doing, right? She picked up my milk content, she busted me. So I thought, okay, what am I going to do now? So I put all my vegetables in my pants pocket. The watery coleslaw, the wet spinach, the pickled beets went inside. The mushy broccoli went inside. And back then, that was 1960-something. 1965. Only had the wax paper sandwich bag. I wasn't smart enough to line my pockets with something. They just went right in. My mom would wash clothes every day at 3 o'clock. And you could hear her yelp a little bit, scream a little bit, when she was pulling out the spinach and the coleslaw. And every day.
No.
So if you met her today, she would tell you. She never believed that I was going to be in this business when I said I'm going to cooking school. That's why I said, take a thank you bite.
Why did you go to cooking school?
Because I wanted to be a better manager. I was a restaurant manager by 19 years old. I started as a dishwasher and wanted to be the best dishwasher, the fastest and most helpful dishwasher.
Where did you start?
At Don the Beachcomber Restaurant in Waikiki, at the Waikiki Beachcomber Hotel. I got promoted to busboy. So I wanted to be the best busboy, fastest, most helpful, cleanest busboy that they had. Plus, I wanted to make more money and become a waiter. So I did that and became a waiter. And so I wanted to be the best waiter I could be. And so that started my climb in the restaurant. Then I became a host. I was a head host. Was a cashier. You know, even did a stint for a year at the front desk clerk, front desk cashier. Went back to the restaurant as a restaurant manager. And then somebody came along and says, hey, you want to be a food and beverage manager one day? You got to go back to culinary school. Okay, because you see the guy behind there? He can run circles around you. You don't know nothing about food. You got to go to school. Technical skill, technical knowledge is what you need. You go to school. So I enrolled at KCC when it was in Pensacola. Right on the corner over there.
Yeah, right.
So that's where I went.
You didn't have to go to chef school to manage a restaurant.
But I did, because my aim was to become a better food and beverage manager.
Huh.
I had to learn the back of the house side. This was a time when the restaurants, the fine dining restaurants, did flambé desserts,
yeah,
table side. They made Caesar salads table side. They did the steak Diane table side, right? That was considered technical knowledge and technical skill. So the guy said to me, your employees will respect you more if you have more technical skill, more technical knowledge than they do. You have to go to school. You have to learn about food.
Hmm.
So my first class was cold food pantry and baking. So if you believe that I only ate 3 vegetables and my mom had to go through what she did, you might believe that I thought bread came out of a package and salad dressing came out of a bottle. I was sort of this, like, I lived in a very tight, I don't know what you call it. I wasn't very exposed or aware of food. And in my first class, we were baking bread. We were making French dressing and salad dressings from scratch. I was making chocolate cake and pies, and in my class, I thought, like, wow. You know, like today, if you go ask a kid where the chicken come from, they might tell you Foodland. Because they never saw chicken being raised. That's true. That was me. So if you was to ask me where the bread come from, oh, Foodland, I never knew you could bake it. I never knew somebody did that. And I used to be a baseball player. I grew up with the baseball under my pillow. Okay. And I never knew that I could make this food with my own hands. Mm-hmm. You know, doing the bread, the pies, the cakes, and the whole thing. So that after that first class, I was hooked.
Oh.
I had to learn more. So I graduated after 2 years. Then I did a culinary apprenticeship in West Virginia. That was a life changer. Because that brought me to New York City after that.
Good test.
All in hopes to become a better food and beverage manager. So I stayed in the back of the house in hopes of going to the front of the house, but I never went back. I stayed. So I started in the front.
Oh, I see. And then at some point, your goal started to be making great food. You know, usually people don't find out late in life that they like to make things, you know?
And you have to pay your dues and go through this long process of learning how to cook, and what I call, before you get the aha moments, the light bulb moments, where you understand it, and now you can just play with it, because you understand the base. So I'm teaching school now at KCC.
Are you?
So I was a student and a teacher. No, this is a story. I was teaching school. So I was teaching the classic salad dressing, the emulsification of oil and vinegar. This one girl says, here, my mom said to give you this, and she gave me pickled mango. So I made pickled mango vinaigrette. Was born grilled chicken breast with pickled mango vinaigrette salad. So the light bulb came on when I said, if I can take a French technique, incorporate something so local like pickled mango, what else can I make an emulsified dressing with? So I tried every local thing under the sun, including Kahlua pig. Okay? Kahlua pig didn't work. But the light bulb came on, and I tried everything, and I knew what did work and what didn't work. So the light bulb came on, so that I now want to incorporate local flavors and local ingredients into my cooking. That's the one dish I made that the light bulb came on that opened the floodgates. True story. There were many along the way, but that was the first one.
The dressing.
Pickled mango.
Oh man, that's so classic.
That dish was on my opening menu at the Canoe House at the Matalani.
Is there one dish you have a real particular affection for? That you've made, you created over the years?
No, there are many, you know, and the ones that have a story and how they happen, how it happened, how it developed, the story is dear to me, but, you know, this might sound cliche, but my favorite dish is going to be the next one I create. I'm looking for it. There's a difference between someone waiting for it to happen to you versus you looking for it. When you're looking for it, your antennas are always up. I can get inspired by so many different things. I could go to your house for lunch and I can get inspired. It doesn't have to be a very elaborate thing. Anything. Something that triggers me because my antennas are out already. I'm looking for stuff. A misconception about, I told you, Hawaiians and Hawaii food, or food of modern day Hawaii. But, you know, the world thinks that we eat pineapples on everything, right? You put sliced pineapple in a burger, it's a Hawaiian burger, a Hawaiian pizza. That's another misconception. Another misconception is in the early days when we had Don the Beachcomber and Trader Vic's. Remember those restaurants?
Yeah.
They had Chinese cooks. So I know because I worked in one of them. They had Chinese spare ribs. They had Chinese food. And sometimes it was sweet and sticky. Like the spare ribs were sweet and sticky. Mm-hmm. And so Hawaii got this kind of like label that Hawaiian food was all about sweet and icky, sticky.
Hmm.
Comes in the teriyaki-ish flavors.
Mm-hmm.
Or the sweet sour flavors, because that's the kind of food that they used to serve at Trader Vic's and Don the Beachcomber. And it was hugely popular with the tourists, for the Haole people. They're coming for the Mai Tais, the Blue Hawaiis and the Chi-Chi's and the Scorpion drinks, the Tiki drinks, and that kind of food. That was very popular, as well as the continental drinks.
Yeah.
So that's what they think Hawaiian food is. Sweet, sticky. Besides pineapple. Or Spam, or macadamia nuts.
Huh.
Yeah.
So it was a big deal announcing that there really is a new cuisine here.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that was a big deal to announce.
We're using different ingredients, you know. We're using more locally raised things and taking the ethnic ingredients and making a mainstream. And we're saying, hey, the stuff that we got is just as good as the French stuff.